Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte, episode 26 for March 6th, 2008, SQL Lite. It's time for Floss Weekly, and ladies and gentlemen, the most hated man in the Blender community, Mr. Randall Schwartz.
Hi, Leo. I earned that title, I think.
No, you didn't. No, you didn't. I thought it was really fun interviewing the Blender fellas, and we didn't make any bones about being users or knowing it. And frankly, you know, for me, that's normal. I mean, we're interviewing people about a lot of open source stuff that I've never used or, you know, don't know much about.
Well, as he even said in the thread that started some of the controversy on Blender Nation, if you guys want to go look it up. But don't. It's a couple of people that were a bit irate about that.
And they felt like we should have known more. We should have asked more inside questions about Blender, I guess. But
I said, look, if we stopped or if we interviewed only things that both Leo and I use, you know, every day, we'd be done by now.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. And I want to keep interviewing other cool people, one thing that I do use every day that is a really cool project is our today's guest.
Yeah. In fact, we know you use it every day, believe it or not. Everybody who's listening.
Everybody uses it. It's SQLite, and it's been around only for less than a dozen years, or less than a decade, actually. And it's what I like about it is it lets me drop a full-featured SQL database into an application without installing anything. I don't have to set up a client and a server and install this library and download that. In fact, most applications that use SQLite actually have SQLite embedded in it, so you don't even know you're using it. For example, something like Apple Mail or
it's on the OS X,
right?
In general, but you know what's interesting. I didn't realize this. We'll ask Richard this, but even though it's already on OS X, it also comes with some programs like Mozilla includes SQLite because it's small enough. It's a few hundred K, so they just include it.
And the other thing that's interesting about this is that, from what I understand, it's completely open source. I mean, it's like anybody can take it and do whatever they want to with it, and that's led it to being embedded in all these wonderful applications and being used in all sorts of ways. I'm sure we'll get into some of those.
And it has a happy ending because Richard Hip, the guy we're going to talk to in just a minute, not only did he give it away, but he's now making a good living supporting it and keeping it alive. And that's kind of the best of all possible situations, if you ask
Absolutely.
Me. That's
Absolutely.
What open source is all about. Hey, let's get him on the phone. He's from North Carolina. D. Richard Hip, Dr. Hip, the creator of SQLite. So you must be happy that SQLite is everywhere, Richard.
Well, I mean, I'm honored and thrilled. I've done so many different open source projects and, you know, the others, you know, they'll get 5 downloads a year or something. And SQLite just sort of took off.
Now, yeah, I actually wanted to thank you, Richard, on behalf of the thousands of users that use your product every day and the millions of users who don't know they're using it.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know who those users are either. I mean,
well, it's kind of like MySQL. It's infrastructure for so much stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And every now and then somebody will call me and say, oh, yeah, we've been using SQLite in our product for years and we have a question. You know?
Right.
Well, that's good to know.
So how might people be – first of all, can you – obviously because of the SQL in the name, it's a database. How would you compare SQLite to SQL Server or MySQL?
Well, it's a totally different – it tries to solve a totally different problem. Most of the other SQL database engines are – well, they're trying to solve the classic database engine problem where you have a server that is managing a lot of different clients. And SQLite, it's solving a very different problem. It wants to be your application file format. Now, sure, it happens to speak SQL, which I'm told is the most widely known programming language in the world. And that makes it really convenient. It gives you transactions and it gives a language that everybody knows how to operate with. But it in no way is trying to compete with MySQL or PostgreSQL or SQL Server or Oracle. On the website, one of the things we say, one of our slogans is that SQLite is not trying to compete with, it's not trying to replace Oracle, it's trying to replace FOpen.
Which, of course, is the low-level C call for opening a file to access it.
Exactly. Most there are just a million applications out there that, you know, people, they open a disk file and they read from it. Sometimes they'll read XML. Sometimes they'll read their own proprietary stuff. And then they'll write to it and so forth. The goal of SQLite is instead of doing fopen and fread and fwrite, you put all of your data in a database file, and you connect to the database file, and then you run SQL queries against it.
So instead of having like inventing my own file format that would be a structure, and then having to write, you know, hundreds of lines of C code or high level language code or something to access that, you're basically taking a single file. As I understand this, taking a single file and putting a SQL interface in front of it so that you can use traditional SQL access methods to access the structure in this file. Is that a fair summary?
That's what I'm trying to get across, yes.
Okay, yes.
Now many languages, I mean, I know Randall Perl has a facility to do this in Python too, in various ways. I know you love SQLite, so how is this different than using those built-in databasing capabilities?
You asking me?
Yeah, I'll ask you, okay. Randall, since you use it.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about SQLite,
and since you're a Perl advocate, so.
Yes. Well, Perl has a couple of really low-level basic things. There's basically an interface to the original legacy 20-year-old DBM library to provide a little bit of structure to a file. And there are various libraries on the CPAN to do things like put a higher-level structure to it. But one of the things I like that's on the CPAN, in fact, and how I got introduced to SQLite, is that there is a module called dbd:\sqlite that not only contains the normal DBI-DBD interface, let me get geeky here for a second, sorry, but it contains the normal interface where I normally would talk to a database and send it SQL in a very organized way, but it contains the entire SQLite source code. So that when I install this module from the CPAN, I don't have to go to some third place and now go get SQLite. The module installs SQLite as well. So I just have to install this thing, and now I have an SQL interfacing data server that looks like I'm talking to a real server, and all I did was install one module from the CPAN.
So a lot easier from the programmer's point of view. And of course, I became aware of it in two ways. Ruby on Rails has support for it, and then it came with my Mac. Was it Tiger that started, or was it Panther?
I think it was Tiger was the first one.
And that's really cool. Now, from the end user's point of view, it's not something I would read or write to an SQLite database.
Well, you could go to your terminal window and type SQLite 3, and you'll actually be talking to the command line interface for SQLite in Leopard or in Tiger. And in fact, you could say there, select date parens quote now quote, and you get the current date. You know, that's pretty cool.
So the common users in fact have done talking directly to an SQLite database on a Mac. About a year ago, somebody discovered that if they find the database that controls the Mac email client, and they go in and they vacuum the database, the email comes up much faster.
Oh. Yes.
Oh. And there were a lot of blog posts around about this about a year or so ago. Now, the later releases of the email system on the Mac, I'm told they do this automatically, so you don't have to do it anymore. But for a while there, people were reporting that by vacuuming that database, email came up in 1 second instead of 50.
Wow.
It was a huge win.
Well, there's a new auto vacuum in the latest SQLites, right? So they probably just turn that back on.
The auto vacuum thing is a little bit different. We put that in there for some cell phone people. The vacuum command it goes through and it regroups everything together in close proximity on the disk.
Ah.
SQLite databases tend to get fragmented because it tries to keep the database file very small. And if you're familiar with traditional file systems, like the Berkeley file system, they do a good job of keeping things defragmented as long as you have plenty of free space on the disk. As soon as your disk gets almost full, then things start to fragment very badly. And we've got the same problem with SQLite. So unfortunately, the data tends to get spread out through across the file. But vacuum pulls it all back together again and makes access very quick.
Neat. I'm doing it right now. I don't know if it does anything in Tiger, but it's kind of cool. So vacuum is a way of rebuild. Is it rebuilding the index? Is it optimizing? What is it doing?
It really goes through and rebuilds the entire database.
Oh, wow. So this is going to take a while. I have a very big database.
It really shouldn't. It takes, 1 or 2 seconds per megabyte.
Oh, that's not bad.
That's still just amazing to me that what you've managed to do here is take, in essentially a single or just a few files, .c files and a few .h's, I guess, I can drop your package, I can drop SQLite into my application and get an SQL parser, something that manages transactions, something that manages, this SQL is really full SQL as far as I can tell. It's got triggers, it has views, it has joins and everything you would normally find in SQL, but it's all this one little thing. I mean, it's compared to, say, installing MySQL or Postgres, this is remarkable to me. I'm still stunned by it.
Well, that's one of the goals, to make it easy to install. And in fact, in the recent releases, we do a thing called the amalgamation. There's like 80-some source files that if you were to take the source files directly out of our configuration management system, there's 80-some that actually end up in the library. But we have a build script that takes all of these C code files and header files and concatenates them all together in just the right order. So if you want to include SQLite in your project, there's really only a single file you have to go get, and it's called SQLite3.c.
Wow.
Now, it's a big file. It's 2.5 megabytes, 100,000 lines of code. But you just drop this one C file in the middle of your application and compile it with the rest of your C files, and you have SQLite right there.
Now, this thing is fully multi-user. I mean, you could have multiple people accessing the same database, and you'd get all the transactions and everything, right?
That's correct. Now, the compromise you have is that you lose some concurrency. You can have multiple applications accessing the same database at the same file, but only one of them can be writing to the file at the same instant. So if application A does a begin and a couple of inserts, then application B cannot write to the file until application A does its commit. Normally that's not a problem because applications go in, they do what they're going to do, they commit, they get out, and it takes a few milliseconds, and so the other guy just waits. But there are situations where you really would want to have multiple applications doing long-term transactions, and for something like that, you really need a client-server database engine and all the complications that go with it.
But you really could use this for, say, a small e-commerce website without any hesitation, right?
Sure. There shouldn't be any problem for small websites. The rule of thumb I kind of have in mind that if your website fits on a single machine, it's probably okay to run SQLite on it. When your website gets busy enough that you start going to multiple machines to run it, you really need to look at a client-server database at that point.
Wow.
So let's take a step back and talk about the development of SQLite. Does the project start with you?
Yes, it started with me in the year 2000.
And what was your thinking?
I've always made my living doing custom development work for people, usually decision support type of programs for large companies and that sort of thing. And I was working on a project in 2000, and it was on legacy hardware. It was running on HP UX, and I did the graphical display component of this thing, but it was all database driven, and I had to use their database, which was Informix. Mm. Informix works great once you get it running. The problem is that the high school graduates that were using this system would power cycle it periodically.
Oh dear!
And when the power came back up, sometimes Informix would start. And sometimes it would not. And if it didn't start, certainly my program, which depended upon the database, would not run. Of course, there was nothing really I could do about that. But on the other hand, because my program was the one that they saw, I got the blame for it.
Mm.
And so I thought, wouldn't it be neat if we had a database that just read and write, would read and write directly from disks, so that if the machine came up in a state good enough that you had disk I/O, you could get at your database. And that's really what kind of started this whole idea. So that was SQLite 1. It was based on the back end was GDBM, the GNU database management thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's GPL. So SQLite 1 was GPL.
So were you just writing a front end of GDBM or?
That's pretty much what it was. Yeah. And it was pretty limited because GDBM is a hashing system. It doesn't have B-trees in it. And, you know, this grew and some people found it really interesting. And so I said, well, I'm going to put in B-trees. And so I originally looked at the Sleepy Cat Berkeley DB B-tree system. But after studying that for a while, I decided to write my own. So I just wrote my own, and that was SQLite 2.
Cool.
And then that got really popular and everything, and a lot of companies started to pick up and started using it then, and there was a need to support UTF-16 and some other features, and that was the genesis of SQLite 3, which I think was in 2004.
Hmm.
And it's been growing by gangbusters ever since.
And, you know, of course, you picked a good name because it immediately communicates what it is. And I think that's part of the success, but also because it's not only lightweight and easy, as you said, easy download, but also very snappy.
Well, we try and make it quick, but you know, everybody claims their database is always the fastest.
I know they do, so. Don't they? And in this case, you're not running an enterprise database with millions of transactions a second, so it's not exact. I mean, it doesn't need to be that snappy.
No, well, and really, if you're running. If you don't have a lot of concurrency, SQLite really runs circles around the client server database engines.
Less overhead.
Right, because there's so much less overhead. Where it falls down, if you have 1,000 clients hitting on the database file, the client server database engines will typically run circles around SQLite.
Right.
It depends on what you're trying to do.
But you're really aiming at an application developer who wants a structured way to save data.
That's the primary goal.
And not just structure, but reliability, too.
Right. The other big user is, of course, embedded device manufacturers that they want a database. And I joke that people like cell phones, PDAs, this sort of thing.
Really? Oh, that makes sense, yeah.
And my joke is that all of these people really want to run Oracle on their cell phone.
I believe Apple's announcing that right now as we speak.
Yeah, but there's like... licensing issues, and it's difficult to get Oracle to fit on such a small platform. So
just carry a little hard drive on their shoulder.
Yeah.
I think they probably settle happily in the long run.
Yeah, and the truth is, on a consumer device like that, you don't need a lot of concurrency. I mean,
right.
how many cell phones are serving 1,000 clients at
right,
a time?
Right.
So it really works out okay.
Unless you have an 8-way conference call or something. Yeah. I like the phrase on your website there, small, fast, reliable, choose any three.
Yeah, I wish I could take credit for it. Somebody on the mailing list suggested. And I thought it was good too.
So what do you do for data integrity? What do you do to ensure reliability?
That's a long story.
Good. I asked the tough question. Finally, Randall, I usually ask the cream puff questions.
We've got a layer on the back end that handles all of the interaction with the disk drive. And it whenever you get ready to start a transaction, it creates a rollback journal file.
So it's journaling. Yeah. Okay.
It's journaling. And it preserves copies of everything it's going to overwrite in the journal file and then f-syncs it to the disk drive before it makes any changes to the database file.
Oh, how interesting.
So if you lose power at any point during the transaction, when power comes back up, the next time you go to open the database file, it'll say, hey, look, there's a...
There's some garbage here.
There's a journal file there, and it'll go read the journal file and roll it back and restore
it
to the condition prior to the start of the transaction.
So to a known good state.
A known good state. Now, that's the theory. This, of course, This, of course, depends on the fact that the fsync system call actually works. Fsync is the system call that says to the operating system, hey, flush all this data out of your cache and actually write it onto the oxide of the disk. And fsync is not supposed to return until the information is actually on oxide. Unfortunately, not a lot of fsyncs work as advertised. And you can, in fact, get some corruption during a power cycle if your fsync is not working. But I don't know how to fix that. That's kind of an operating system. Or more importantly, it's the problem seems to be in the disk controllers on commodity disk drives. The disk controller will tell you, oh, sure, I've written it to oxide,
right.
but it's lying. It's still in its track buffer.
Right.
So that's a little bit of a problem, but I have no solution to it. For the other thing about Integrity is we do extensive testing. We have a test harness that we hook up to this thing that simulates an operating system that's crashing or power cycling.
So it's like Windows.
Yeah, something like that. But we can control it very precisely, and we run thousands of scenarios where data is partially written to the disk, or a sector is partially written, and it's written out of order, and all of this, and then we verify that we can recover it correctly.
That's great. So, you know, I'm jesting about Windows, but this actually runs on Windows, doesn't it?
It does. There's a portability layer on the back end that. You can make it work on just about any operating system that supports disk I/O.
Wow.
And so a lot of the embedded device manufacturers who are using SQLite, they have to come up with their own back end because they're running some proprietary, sometimes homegrown operating system. And so they have to do their thing there.
Cool.
There are some people who are using SQLite as their file system.
And see, that's a very interesting application. I know that both Microsoft and Apple want to move to kind of databasing file systems.
Well, this is on embedded devices, and they've got a little miniature file system that you know they've pulled together. Maybe it's got some kind of stripped down Linux kernel, or maybe it's something of their own.
Is Symbian doing this?
No, Symbian has a real file system on theirs.
Okay,
but there are other people who are doing like smart cards and things, mm-hmm. and they. They don't have a file system, but what they do is they put in a special back end on SQLite that just says, hey, this whole flash chip, that's your database.
Huh.
And then rather than doing opening and reading and writing the files as you traditionally would, they just create tables and write to the tables.
Yeah, if you could preserve the state of your memory, I mean, there's you have a memory-based file, memory-based table, memory-based database option, if I recall, right? So you can say this database is in memory, right?
Yeah. The way that works is of course SQLite has its own little disk cache, so that as you're reading it and writing, it doesn't write the same page of the database multiple times, right, in quick succession, which would be wasteful,
right? Hmm.
And when you specify memory, all it does is it just never flushes that disk cache out to disk. So that it just holds everything in the disk cache, and it works the same way. It just never writes to disk.
Now, that's cool.
Now, Richard is in – you're in North Carolina, yeah?
I'm in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Charlotte. And I'm sure if you were in the West Coast, you'd be right now sitting in Cupertino at Apple's announcement because, among other things – they have SQLite on the iPhone.
You know, people tell me that.
They've just announced it.
They have announced it. That's great. We have a complete set of
APIs for your app to talk directly to the contact database on the iPhone and an entire database API with SQLite.
How about that? That's really cool.
So you didn't know that?
Well, I didn't know it for sure. I mean, people have written to me. They've reverse engineered their iPod, and they say, hey, did you know there's SQLite in there? No, I didn't. Thanks for telling me. I actually asked the people at Apple about this, and they came back and said, we can neither confirm nor deny those rumors.
That's a confirmation. I would imagine. That's great.
But that's interesting to know. They've officially announced it now.
It's part of the API. They have database access to SQLite. So.
Well, that would seem normal since part of the the core data since Tiger. So, SQLite's just been in there. On the user side of it, it just looks like you've got this wonderful SQL interface to some magical processing in the background. And in fact, really, it's SQLite.
Yeah, what they announced in Cupertino was essentially that this is a Macintosh, this iPhone is. They've finally come clean on this, that, you know, that's the OS 10 kernel. The app frameworks are there, and they built a version of Cocoa that's for touchscreen on top of the core services and the kernel.
Like, we didn't know that since August.
I mean, that's pretty obvious. But what's nice is the API will be, you know, a little more straightforward for those of you who have programmed for Cocoa before, because it'll be Cocoa.
So SQLite's on the iPhone. It's on Symbian phones. It's on the Google phone.
It's part of Android.
Built into Android.
That's great.
And it's also in several other brands of cell phones whose manufacturers have asked me to keep quiet about it, so I can't identify them. But it's a good chance if you have a cell phone that's a copy of SQLite running on it somewhere.
Is there another lightweight database system like that that might be a competitor? Or I mean, sounds. I think you've got the market locked.
There are certainly a lot of people who compete with it. If you do a Google search for SQLite, you'll find a number of paid links on the side of.
We've got a better solution.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Five times faster than SQLite. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I think I realized that I was sort of a contender when everybody started comparing their database to SQLite.
and I noticed that this product is for embedded. I mean, that sounds like probably the big market for this.
Yeah, that's certainly the market that keeps the lights on here.
The money making market. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's where a lot of the interest is, but it's used by a lot of different things. Certainly, you know, Mozilla's using it in Firefox and.
Oh, really? So if you install Firefox, you get a copy of SQLite.
That's correct.
A separate copy.
Well, it's small.
Well, but that's okay. Some people are worried about. You know, they want to install SQLite, and I'm thinking, why do you want to do that? Just statically link it with your application. Some people have this mindset that they always want to have a DLL or a shared library.
Right.
I'm thinking, why? If you statically link it, it's not that big. It's 250 kilobytes. Statically link it, and then you never have to worry about library incompatibilities or anything like that. We work really hard to keep the library fully backwards compatible. But sometimes we find people who write code that depends upon bugs. And then when the bugs get fixed, their code breaks. So
if you write to the bugs, at least a static bug.
We do not try and preserve backwards compatibility to bugs.
Now, you said SQLite version 1 was GPL, was it? And what's the current license on SQLite?
It's public domain.
Really?
We released it into the public domain when I went to version 2.
Essentially, no license at all.
No license at all. And this has turned out to be a very controversial thing. I thought it would be great. People could just use it. I took my name completely off the code. My plan was to give it away for free.
Richard.
To sort of remain anonymous, to never make any money from it. That plan didn't work out so well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, frankly. Why were you being so altruistic?
Well, it just was just the right thing to do. I had found the code to be very useful in the commercial products that I was working on, and I thought other people might find it useful too.
I should mention that Richard is works on a lot of other open source projects. You're still a member of the Tickle Core team. You do work on a CVS track. There's an OpenGL widget for Tickle TK called 3D Canvas, an HTML widget called TK HTML. There's Lemon, which is a parser generator. Parser generator.
Parser generator, sort of a Yak replacement. I put that's an example of an open source product that I put out there around 1990. This was before the World Wide Web. I mean, I posted it to Complang C.
Ooh.
And it was.
I remember
utterly,
those days.
Yes, it was utterly ignored for 20 years, or for 10 years. And
everybody
then,
had Yak.
Well, exactly. And I thought that Lemon had certain advantages over Yak, and I used it in the parser for SQLite. And then when SQLite got real popular, people started saying, well, what parser generator do you use? Oh, Lemon. Oh, I think I'll use that too. And suddenly Lemon took off as sort of a side effect. But Lemon is sort of is very typical of the open source projects that I've developed myself, in that five downloads a year or something like that.
You're prolific, but do you work mostly by yourself? I mean, what's interesting about all your projects is they're small, human scale that somebody, one person could work on. They're not massive, things like Mozilla.
No, yeah, I do tend to work on projects by myself, but I mean, there are we've got some really great helpers with SQLite now. Dan Kennedy has contributed, I think, like last time I checked, about 30% of the code in SQLite at this point.
Wow,
he does fabulous work. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned the HTML widget for TickleTK. I sort of toss that over the wall, and Dan has been maintaining that for the last couple of years, and he added all sorts of capabilities to it. And
are you doing these in public domain too, or do you use GPL for those? Or
it varies. I think that I passed off all of my contributions to the HTML widget to the public domain. I'd have to go and check what and see what Dan's.
Do you find that putting it in public domain makes it easier to get people to work on it, or harder? Easier to get people to adopt it, or harder?
Well, I thought it would make it easier, but
I think some people want a license.
They really do, and there was some buzz on the blogosphere a couple weeks ago about people saying, well, public domain does not comply with the OSI rules for open source. It's not really open source if it's public domain.
Hmm.
Now, I don't really follow the reasoning behind that, because you've got the source code, you can do whatever you want with it. Why is that not open source?
Right.
But because it's not a license, people are somewhat, they don't really know what to do about it. I didn't realize it would be controversial that way when I selected it back in 2001.
I believe the controversy is that there are a few countries that don't recognize your ability to release all rights. And as a result, saying something is public domain in those countries would be the same as saying it's completely locked up.
And according to Larry Lessig, the U.S. is one of those countries.
Really?
Yeah. He that's why he created Creative Commons. He said, you really can't put something into the public domain. You need to be explicit. I don't want to argue with Richard. I think it's an altruistic it's a truly altruistic thing to do, and I honor you for it. And this is, it's really nitpicking to say, well, you need a license or you have, but that's Larry's position on the. In fact, he went through this with Trent Reznor when Nine Inch Nails, they just released their album under a Creative Commons license, and they wanted to just do it public domain, and he convinced them that really it's better to do it Creative Commons, because then you give explicit rights to do things like mix-ins and mashups, and being explicit, I guess, for the lawyers out there is preferable to implicit.
The other big project that we've actually talked about on Floss Weekly in the past that has this same sort of altruistic, totally open license is Perl. The artistic license is essentially a public domain license. And it's interesting, Richard, I don't know if you know, but you and Larry share a background in your relationship with Wycliffe.
I didn't realize that Larry was involved with Wycliffe.
Yeah.
I've met Larry, I think, twice at OSCON or something, but we've never really sat down and talked.
Yeah, well, originally what Larry was going to do in the world was go out and, be a translator. That was his job. And ended up deciding not to do that, and ended up creating this wonderful little language that I know a little bit about instead. But it's interesting that you both of you came up with this very generic language for a project that was useful to you, and yet the world could take advantage of, and both became very successful at that.
So,
interesting.
I'm honored to be compared with Larry.
do you regret now putting it in public domain? I mean,
knowing what I do now, I probably would have done something like the artistic license. But
advice to somebody who's considering this issue now would be artistic license or something like that.
I think so. Now, when I was trying to decide what to do, transitioning from SQLite 1, which had to be GPL because it was linking against GPL code.
Right.
To SQLite version 2, I was trying to decide what license, and really in my mind, the licenses were GPL, LGPL, and the Berkeley license.
Right.
And those were my choices, and I thought, well, LGPL is still too restrictive, and I could do Berkeley, but what's really the point? Why not just say public domain? Mm-hmm. And I wasn't aware of the pitfalls of countries that don't recognize public domain and the nervousness that this causes of large businesses who want to deploy many copies of this sort of thing.
You know, I'm not a lawyer, but given that it's already in public domain, you could actually release the next release under the artistic license without any problem.
I could, but somehow
that would at least have a license.
Yeah. Well,
but then it would have a license. It would have a license everybody could agree on.
It would feel like a backward step, though, I
think. Yeah.
It feels like a backward step. There are a lot of companies who have lawyers that are very concerned about this. And so we do have this contingency license. And companies who are deploying many copies of SQLite can come to us and pay a small fee, and we'll write up a contingency license that basically says if the public domain status is ever goes away for this, then they have unlimited rights to do whatever they want with it.
Do you make money on SQLite or on consulting on it, or?
My initial plan was not to. I mean, I made my money writing proprietary software for people, but companies started coming to me and said, "Hey, we want to pay you to extend SQLite in this way or that, or to make this custom feature for us." And so it turned into a business. It was not my plan to do that, but it's turned into one, and now that's what I do full time.
Well, that's great. That just shows you altruism is often a great thing for you personally too.
It worked out well this time. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it often does. I think it's a little scary at first.
Well, it's altruism mixed with some cleverness, because you've done, it's also created this a wonderful product on top of that.
I mean, it certainly helps that you're obviously brilliant and you do great stuff. Yeah. It doesn't hurt, you know, to give away something that shows off so well what you do. So you were able to do this because there is no GPL code in this at all. This is all written from scratch by you.
Yes. Every bit of it was written from scratch by me or by Dan. There's actually, let's wait just a second for that phone to finish ringing.
Sorry, we can't really hear it anyway.
Okay. There's actually a dozen or so contributors to the project, but in order to protect the public domain status of the code, I require that everybody who checks in to the source tree sign a copyright disclaimer, mm-hmm. a piece of paper, and actually mail it to me. And I have the originals in my fire safe here in my office.
Mm.
This came up with some of the big commercial users of SQLite. They, you know, their lawyer teams wanted documentary proof that this was in the public domain, and so they want me to maintain that and are willing to actually send me a little bit of money to make sure I maintain those pieces of paper.
Robert, now, go ahead.
That interferes with getting people to contribute a little bit, in the sense that before you can contribute code, you have to print out a document, read over it, sign it. If you work for somebody else as a W-2 employee, you have to get your employer to sign it as well. Mm-hmm. And then you have to send it through me through the post. And you have to go through all these hoops before you can contribute code, which tends to keep the number of developers down, unfortunately.
Now, these people that approached you to pay you, those are mostly enhancements, right?
Initially, it was mostly enhancements. But now we're seeing companies that where SQLite has become an important part of their infrastructure, such as Symbian. I mean, it's in their operating system on their cell phone. It's the core database there, or Mozilla.
It's in AIR too, isn't it?
It's in Adobe products in their Lightroom.
Do they use it in AIR? Is it part of the AIR?
It's in AIR, and I'm told that it's in a lot of other Adobe products, but I don't know what they are.
It's probably not in Silverlight, I would guess. But
not yet, anyway.
It may change.
But it's in all these products, and so these companies recognize that this is an important part of their infrastructure, and so we've set up this thing called the SQLite Consortium. And these companies contribute an annual fee, which allows Dan Kennedy and I to have a salary.
That's great.
And we spend full time maintaining the code, improving it, working through any bugs that come up.
That's as it should be. I mean, they're using it. This is part of their business. They darn well ought to support you in keeping it, you know, vital and alive.
And it works out well for them because you know, even this annual fee, it's still a really, really cheap way to get a good database for them, because they're pushing out millions of these, and if they were to have pay even a penny per copy, it would cost them more than what they're paying me by far.
Richard Axatura says that you're probably the most embedded application or most embedded tool anywhere. I mean, it's in everything.
Well, I'm not sure the most embedded tool. I mean,
well, if it's in all those phones, it's in certainly. You know, let's see. If it's in all the Symbian phones, it's in.
All the iPhones.
You're talking millions and millions.
I think it's probably the most widely deployed SQL database.
Well, we'll say that for sure. There's no question about that.
Clearly,
but on the other hand, you know, people point out that a single Oracle database might do millions and millions of transactions per day. So it depends on how you measure. I mean,
You don't do the most transactions.
Don't do the most transactions but I have the most deployments.
Yeah.
Actually, you don't know. I mean, with that millions of phones out there, it might be actually, one per, distributed computing there.
Well, maybe.
And all the Ruby, all the Ruby on Rails implementations, all the Macs. Yeah. I mean, now that it's in air, it's going to be everywhere. I mean, it must be gratifying to you. I mean, you've been doing it 8 years and here it is everywhere.
It amazes me still.
One of the things that it hasn't been mentioned yet, I just wanted to bring up, is that I, as a developer, have used SQLite a number of times to prototype an application on my laptop at 30,000 feet or out at sea on one of my cruises, where I don't have access to the original full, like MySQL or Postgres system that's been installed. And then I just take my app, once I've tested it against SQLite, I can drop it in once I get back, on the ground or on shore. And it just works because I have a full SQL implementation. I can do this sort of preview testing disconnected.
Yeah, that's a useful thing for it. The problem with that is there are no two database engines in the world that work exactly alike.
Sure.
But as long as you stay to the core features of SQL, inserts and selects and updates and deletes, you're pretty safe.
Yeah, and I'm using, for the Perl applications I'm doing, I'm using a thing called RoseDB, which sits as a layer between my Perl app and the underlying database. So the actual low-level calls change depending on whether I'm talking to Postgres or SQLite. And so that actually is kept away from me transparently, which is nice. And I just develop the app at my level, and I know the right stuff's being done underneath by RoseDB to call the appropriate things about, say, how to create a serial column or an automatic incrementing column, that kind of stuff. That's all handled automatically for me.
Well, that's the right way to do it, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. But this is a whole other area. I don't know if you envisioned this when you were creating SQLite, that this would be a preview database when people are actually building larger systems.
No, we tell people one of the possible uses for it is for development work. If you've got a development team working on a product, and it's a whole lot easier for a developer to do experiments on a database that's just a file on their PC rather than having to manage MySQL or PostgreSQL or Oracle. Mm-hmm. And then you do development work on SQLite, and then you cut over to your client-server database engine later. It's also good for demos, or like if you're at a trade show, if you've got some product that's really a database interface product, but you want to hand out demo CDs to people who walk by and you don't want to have to force them to install Oracle in order to run your software, just make it run off of SQLite instead. Zero administration. It's just there. It just works.
And training, too. You can give all your students a copy of SQLite and say, here, you go play with it, take it on your laptop home, and bring back your homework.
I've talked to a number of university faculty, and they use SQLite for their database class because they can just tell the students, here, use this database, and they don't have to spend a lot of time installing or administering a client-server database.
And you support a full range of SQL commands and so forth?
Yes. The only things we don't support are things that don't really make sense, like since an SQLite database is just a file on the disk, grant and revoke for permissions, that doesn't really make sense. It's just a file. Some things like that we don't do.
Right.
We parse referential integrity constraints, but we don't enforce them.
Although you can enforce them with triggers now, right?
You can enforce them with triggers, but they're not enforced by default. And there's a few obscure things. We do left outer joins, but not right outer joins. And every release, we do a little bit more. Eventually, we'll do it all, but
that's pretty amazing.
Yet.
And what a great learning tool if you wanted to, you know, practice your SQL.
Yeah, that's if somebody's trying to learn SQL or SQL in general, they can just fire up the command line shell and start typing right away without having to do any setup and having to set up all the permissions.
Right.
And one of the applications I did, I actually provided a Perl function to the SQL. So I attached a Perl function. So in the middle of my SQL expression, I was able to call back to Perl to do some parsing that SQL wouldn't do directly. And that was real easy to do. I couldn't have done that with Postgres or MySQL. It would have been very difficult to do. So this is also good for that sort of stuff as well.
I'm impressed, Richard. I mean, clearly you've done something so amazing that it's everywhere and slick and light and fast. It's kind of the ideal for a programming. I haven't looked at the source code. I'm going to have to look at it. Is it designed for others to look at and learn from?
It's originally designed for that. I've tried my best to keep it clean and easy to understand, but we have the competing goal of also making it fast and small.
Uh-huh.
And to the extent those three goals are compatible, we do that. But sometimes in order to make things fast and small, you have to pull some dirty tricks in the implementation, which might not be the most easy to read. But we do comment everything carefully and try and choose reasonable variable names. I think the source code is like 35% comment, so it should be relatively easy to read.
That's a lot. Wow.
If the we try and keep it modular, there's some documentation on the website that shows you the major subsystems within SQLite, and once you understand that, you can find the one file you're interested in, and most people can pick it up and read it pretty easily.
That's great.
Now, also on the website, you have a wiki, so people can contribute their own observations or their own applications and update information that way. You also have a really nice log of all the changes you're making in CVS. You have full access to the CVS. It's really amazing how open you've made this project.
Yes, of course, all of that wiki and that log are backed by an SQLite database, of course.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah, I love that. So you can query the SQLite database and look at the CVS, and that's really neat. That's really neat.
It's amazing.
I just love that. Yeah. Well, we really appreciate your taking the time to talk to us, Richard, and it's to kind of see the man behind this most embedded software of all time.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to have been called.
Oh, that's great.
Well, that was a great conversation. I really am happy to have finally talked to this guy who, actually, I didn't know his name until a few weeks ago.
Well, because he took it out of the source.
Yes, it's completely, he's probably one of the most humble people I've met in this conversation. I mean, I really did want to compare him to Larry Wall because I know Larry being the same sort of just, I produced this wonderful thing, but I'm just really not pouting my own horn about it. Richard is clearly in that category of the kind of people that do great stuff, really great stuff that changes the fundamental nature of how we work with our day-to-day activities. And yet just, oh, this is just something I've done and go ahead and use it and it's going to be useful and take it and do whatever you want to with it. And
it's amazing. Yeah. It's just amazing. I didn't want to, you know, embarrass him or anything, but I'm very impressed. Really, really impressed. This is, to me, this is kind of pure programming where a guy has a deep understanding of the issues, has a love of programming, and just by himself with help, of course, but ultimately, initially by himself, just creates this work of art and then gives it away. I mean, that's really, to me, the true artistic expression of computer programming.
Absolutely. He's definitely going to go down and with a legacy that's well deserved of having contributed to you know, everything in this era of programming.
Yeah, he's done a very nice job, too. I'm just looking through the CVS database on sqlite.org, and it's just really great. I mean, it and of course, it's snappy and fast, and there's a wiki, and it's very impressive. Not a lot of frills, and that's what I kind of like about the idea. It just gets the job done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you picked a winner.
Very good. I only had one question I forgot to ask him while he was on, but I couldn't figure out which side is the ox side.
That's good.
Is it the left
like
or the
that.
Right?
Yeah, he was talking about saving to the oxide using a...
Yeah,
yes,
maybe
yes.
It's the oxide and the said side.
Yes,
I don't know.
Oxide. Huh. I don't know. We'll have to have that one for another day.
Okay. Maybe I'll find an expert on that.
We can ask Emo about that, or Richard Lewis or somebody. Which side is the oxide? You are a silly, silly person.
Oh, man.
So our stated goal, Randall, to get this back to a weekly show. And I think we're close to it. We've got three more interviews to do in the next few weeks.
Huh?
I'm very excited about that.
So. I am too. They're just lining up like hotcakes. And you guys, you out there in the audience, I really appreciate this. You're sending in ideas,
yes.
And it makes it so much easier for me to just go out and look up the email contact. Of course, if you can send that along, that helps too. But if you know, I'm getting great suggestions for people to line up. Now it's more a matter of finding the time that Leo and I, busy as we are, to hook up together. But we're finding time to do that.
Well, it's the cruises that really get in the way.
the cruises
and the
your
conferences.
And your darn radio show and all
well,
the other podcasts.
I've stopped going to Vancouver now, so I will be here all the time. So we'll work it around your schedule. We'll make sure
Definitely.
That we get the most shows in.
Very good.
Well done, Randall. Thank you so much, and we'll see you all next time on Boss Weekly.